I invite you, as we move into this time of meditation, to first perhaps glance out of one of the windows of the sanctuary. And then, if you feel comfortable, I invite you to close your eyes and spend some time looking at your inner landscape, the landscape of your being this day. Our Quaker brothers and sisters often ask, how is it with your soul? And as you gaze upon the inner landscape of your being, how is it with your spirit this morning? Are you troubled, worried about the state of our world? The people of Kiev or Syria or the West Bank? Perhaps your worries are more close at hand. A loved one, a family member, a friend who is struggling. Or perhaps your worries are personal. Perhaps the answer to the question, how is it with your soul, is not a happy one. Whatever answers you find this morning, this is a time for you. This is a time for grieving, for hoping, for loving, for holding all that is your life. For pausing and giving space and time for all that you need to be with. May we, in the midst of this winter, the beauty that surrounds us, find some of our childlike joy. Find it hard to sit still. Find it in our hearts to make snow angels. For even amidst the challenges in life, we must allow some beauty to enter. And so for all of this, for all the people that we have brought into our hearts in this time, we lift our hearts in prayer. Amen. Thank you for that lovely song, choir. I was joking with the choir this morning that I thought we might have just a barbershop quartet this morning. I wasn't sure. It's a very Canadian thing to wake up in the morning and say, I'm not sure whether a 4 a.m. hockey game or snowfall will keep people from church this morning. I've never had a 4 a.m. hockey game be a cause for some concern, but we were in a children's bookstore yesterday, and there was a book that said, H is for hockey. I said, I know I'm in Canada, amen. Well, I knew the hardy humanists would be out with us this morning in the snow, and our reading this morning is an excerpt from the Humanist Manifesto, which was written in 1933 and signed by 34 signatories, 9 of whom were Unitarian or Universalist ministers. I adapted some of the language to make it a bit more, shall we say, gender inclusive. Religion consists of those actions, purposes, and experiences which are humanly significant. Nothing human is alien to the religious. It includes labor, art, science, philosophy, love, friendship, recreation, all that is in its degree expressive of intelligently satisfying human living. The distinction between the sacred and the secular can no longer be maintained. Religious humanism considers the complete realization of human personality to be the end purpose of human life and seeks its development and fulfillment in the here and now. This is the explanation of the humanists' social passion. Believing that religion must work increasingly for joy in living, religious humanists aim to foster the creative in humanity and to encourage achievements that add to the satisfactions of life. The goal of humanism is a free and universal society in which people voluntarily and intelligently cooperate for the common good. Humanists demand a shared life in a shared world. Though we consider the religious forms and ideas of our fathers no longer adequate, the quest for the good life is still the central task for humankind. Humanity is at last becoming aware that we alone are responsible for the realization of the world of our dreams, that we have within ourselves the power for its achievement. We must set intelligence and will to the task. Spiritual humanism. As I hear many of the debates within our congregation and within Unitarian Universalism more broadly, I can't help but think our ancestors in this tradition must be sharing some knowing smiles of recognition and perhaps an occasional chuckle. That is, of course, if you believe that they are somewhere in a cloud of witnesses. Some of them don't even believe they are in heaven or in some cloud of witnesses. But wherever they may connect with one another, if they do so, I think our ancestors in this tradition are chuckling as you are now. Many of the debates and dilemmas that we wrestle with now in our theologically pluralistic and open tradition are not, and I repeat, not in any way new. If anything, I think our forebears would likely wish that we paid more attention to them, learned from their wisdom, and saw in their example some clarity about the strength in our variedness. When you chart the history of our faith, you see our Protestant Christian beginnings and the continued influence of the Judeo-Christian tradition. Unitarianism began, after all, in the 1550s. Then you see a high value placed on the experience, the human experience of the holy, and almost mysticism, if you will, of our transcendentalist forebears in the 1820s and 1830s. And then you keep moving along to get to that humanist manifesto that I read to you, which was written in 1933. Our faith tradition, in short, has always incorporated many strands of belief. The conversation between theological convictions has been going on in our faith for over 500 years. So why do we think we're so special? Through all of the disagreements and differences of opinion, we have stayed together and stayed stronger when we have managed to see these differences not as adversarial or oppositional, but rather as complementary and strengthening. We learn well from one another and continue to grow as we allow ourselves to be moved and impacted by the convictions of others. I have, over the past few years, with the help of some colleagues that I do work with three times a year in Boston, cultivated an increasing soft spot for our ancestors. In fact, the last time I was in Boston, which was one of the last times that the UUA headquarters will be where it currently sits, at 25 Beacon Street, overlooking the Boston Common and next to the State House of Massachusetts, I took myself on a little tour when we were in a break in our meeting. I walked through the hallways of UUA headquarters, poking my head in every office that was open, and specifically looking at all of the painted portraits they had on the walls of the Unitarians and Universalists who made our faith tradition possible. On my little pilgrimage of sorts, I uttered quiet thank yous to them all, those well known to me and those unknown to me. I cherish our forebears as I hadn't before, and see them now, as one of our colleagues in that work likes to say, as part of my family. Humanism. What is it, this humanism? Humanism, you see, values human agency, both individual and collective, and places a high value on rational thought and empirical evidence. But humanism is not monolithic, and it has changed and evolved over time. Some probably of you identify as secular humanists, focused on all that humanity is capable of and explicitly casting aside all engagement with anything considered supernatural or dogmatic. Others amongst us this morning might call themselves religious humanists, those who are interested in the intersection of ritual and beliefs from a spiritual tradition with a humanist outlook. Many forms of humanism share a common focus, an emphasis on human potential and striving, a focus on this life, on the here and now being all that matters, no focus on the next life or next world, if there is one. Humanism tells us that we have a great deal of power, we human beings. This is what I was trying to tell the kids, but they were just a little too antsy to hear this morning. We human beings have a great deal of power, our humanist forebears would tell us. We have the capacity and indeed the responsibility to improve ourselves and to improve our world. Humanism emphasizes the fact that any positive change we hope to see is incumbent upon us. It's like that song about we are the ones that we've been waiting for. Humanism agrees. We must do what we can to make ourselves self-actualized and do what we can to improve the circumstances of all of our fellow human beings. Let me share a little bit about one of our key historical Unitarian figures who I have once again fallen in love with. I thought it was quite funny that when I first started going to these meetings in Boston, they always put me in the room of Curtis Rees. There's a portrait of him that looks at me as I sleep at night. Curtis Rees is one of the key forebears of ours in humanism, and I thought they thought it would be funny to put the theist in the humanist room with Curtis Rees and let us talk through the night with one another. But they could have well put me in the room of John Dietrich, one of the signers of the manifesto that I just read to you. John Dietrich lived from 1878 to 1957. And he began his ministry in the Reformed Christian tradition, Reformed Church tradition. But he was then defrocked in 1911 for failing to affirm primary Christian beliefs, such as the virgin birth, the deity of Jesus, and the infallibility of the Bible. John Dietrich then became a Unitarian. In fact, he was sort of recruited by the Unitarians because he was such a powerful and effective speaker. His churches, every single one he was ever connected with, grew and grew under his leadership. He became a Unitarian and ultimately came to be known as the father of religious humanism. He took the word humanism from an essay that he had read once, and he saw the core of humanism as, and I quote, belief and trust in human effort, end quote. He never rejected theism, that is, Mr. Dietrich never said theists were bunk or that they were misguided or mistaken, but he simply said he himself found no evidence for God. I quote from Dietrich himself. He was the one who wrote a pamphlet that the American Unitarian Association created on humanism in 1934. And Dietrich wrote for that pamphlet, "If we live in a great impersonal universe with no friend to guide," and here I interject, if there is no God, he's essentially saying, "it matters tremendously how we conduct ourselves, for we are actually the makers of human destiny." He continues that it is our responsibility, that our responsibility is, and I quote, "to put beauty in place of ugliness, good in place of evil, laughter in place of tears, to dispel error with knowledge, hatred with love, displace strife and contention with peace and cooperation." Naturalistic humanism, he concluded, brought to him a feeling of bliss, and with it the intense longing that I may so live that posterity may have this feeling more fully and more often in the better world we ourselves must build. End quote. Did you sense in Dietrich's perspective how humanism is spiritual? He talked about a feeling of bliss. He talks about belief and trust. One can be a spiritual humanist or a spiritual atheist or agnostic. It is not a given, but it upsets me that too often the assumption is made that if one is a humanist, then you must not be a spiritual person. I read Dietrich's words and I sense in it a palpable spiritual conviction. I think if we think that humanists and agnostics and atheists are not spiritual people, then we are misdefining the word spiritual. Benedictine monk Brother David Steindl-Rast, who has a lovely TED Talk, by the way, on gratitude, says this in defining spirituality. "Sometimes people get the mistaken notion that spirituality is a separate department of life, the penthouse of existence. But rightly understood, it is a vital awareness that pervades all realms of our being. Wherever we may come alive, that is the area in which we are spiritual." End quote. Did you hear that? A vital awareness. Spirituality is a vital awareness. Wherever you come alive, that is where you are spiritual. Whether or not you believe in God has nothing to do with it. You are a spiritual person if you are alive. If there are things that excite you, if you have a vital awareness that you might hone and train to be more vitally aware more of the time. For humanists, that coming alive is in the recognition that when we tap into our capacity to make a difference, when we trust and believe in the capacity of human community and our place in it, there are limitless possibilities. I think about what happened on the streets of Kiev this week. What would a humanist have to say about that? Humanists, of course, mourn the loss of life and the violence, but humanists might say that shows you what a group of people can do. A group of human beings can overturn a government, can call for freedom, can say now is the time, can say we will not wait. Sounds a little like something Dr. King once said. So whether your source of conviction in what human beings can do comes only from a spiritual perspective of humanism or from a spiritual perspective of theism, wherever the source of your conviction comes from, you are a spiritual person. When you tap into that source of conviction, the belief that you can make it through the challenging moments of your life and the challenging moments that our world throws your way, when doubts threaten to overshadow your hopes, where is your aliveness? That aliveness, which I sometimes refer to as a sense of life's meaning and purpose, has a different source for a humanist than it does for a theist. But both people are seeking to stay connected to the source. Perhaps it's the source of which the choir sang this morning, the source of all with a capital S. Both humanist and theist need to be grounded in the spiritual, in the meaning, in the aliveness, or face a sense of lostness and despair. So humanism, for my money, is a spiritual worldview that draws meaning from our present life and human possibilities. So where am I going, you're wondering? What's the message here? Here's the real sermon part here for you. I fear, my friends, that we too often cast stones at one another's beliefs. Humanists sometimes become too rigid in their convictions and scoff at the naivete of those among us who believe in God. There is no scientific proof, humanists will say. And what kind of rational mind would embrace such a faith stance as theism anyway? Theists among us sometimes feel their spiritual perspective is humble and open and leads to richness and to meaning, and sometimes do not see the wisdom of the humanists in our midst and feel upset that humanists seem so sure of themselves, so enamored of their own rightness. But when we denigrate or demean the beliefs of those among us, don't we just reenact what we decry in the larger world? Think about that for a moment. Really think about that. We say we don't like all this fundamentalism. Fundamentalism in Islam, fundamentalism in Christianity, which says I'm right and everybody else is out to lunch. Well, if we do the same thing, we're no better, friends. If we say my humanism is right and everybody else is out to lunch, then we are doing the same thing. If we wrestle with and disagree with fundamentalisms that we see exerting undue influence in other traditions, then surely we want to strive to continue to hold open space for many theological strands, not wishing that theists or atheists or humanists would have the upper hand. The my way or the highway way of viewing spirituality is misguided and even dangerous, as we've seen in our world. Part of what I love so dearly about Unitarian Universalism is the continual challenge that it offers. I cannot simply adhere to one system of belief or perspective and rest in the certitude that I am right and everyone else around me on Sunday will agree with me. I haven't held that belief in a long time. Rather, as a Unitarian Universalist, I am pushed to remain open. Open to what my own life might still have to teach me, open to the wisdom of what our Unitarian Universalist ancestors might have to teach, open to the thought and words of great spiritual teachers of all traditions, and yes, friends, open to all of you. To continue to seek the beauty and the wisdom and the insights that all of you have to offer. On what makes meaning, what gives purpose, what is important in this life. We have much to gain from one another. Let me close with this. Last spring, I preached a sermon on spirituality for atheists, and I shared some of the words of the late Reverend Dr. Forrest Church, who was minister at All Souls Unitarian in New York for over 30 years before he died after a long battle with esophageal cancer. I shared with you then his metaphor of the cathedral of the world. Some of you might remember it, of one light and many windows, one light being the light of God or truth or source, coming through many windows in the cathedral and different traditions seeing different things refracted in those windows. I close this morning with a few more words of his, which I hope express some of what I have tried to convey this morning. Reverend Church wrote, "If our religion doesn't inspire in us a humble affection for one another and a profound sense of awe at the wonder of being, one of two things has happened. It has failed us, or we it. Should either be the case, we must go back to the beginning and start all over again. We must reboot our lives until the wonder we experience proves itself authentic by the quality of our response to it. The secret lies in how we treat one another. I may not believe as Jesus did, but I should dearly hope to love as Jesus did. To forgive and embrace others as unconditionally as he. The principal challenge of theology today is to provide symbols and metaphors that will bring us, in all of our glorious diversity, into closer and more celebratory kinship with one another as sons and daughters of life and death. Whether you are theist or humanist, may that closer kinship be ours, for we all are sons and daughters in life and death, making meaning and finding our way as best we can. So may it be. And amen.